Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
You ain't heard about Moto Casino?
Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto.
I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps. In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free to play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Let's talk about the prosecution in the case of Corey Richens. Prosecutor Brad Bloodworth opened by telling jurors that Corey Richens murdered her husband for his money and a fresh start at life. The prosecution's case is built on layers. $4.5 million in debt, fraudulently obtained life insurance policy, a Caribbean vacation booked months in advance with her boyfriend, and text messages expressing love to that boyfriend the same night Eric died. They've shown the jury body camera footage of the morning Eric was found, presented testimony from his devastated family, and laid out a timeline suggesting premeditation, going back to an alleged Valentine's Day poisoning attempt. Eric Faddis, defense attorney, drawing on his own prosecutorial background, is with us to help analyze whether this mountain of circumstantial evidence can carry a conviction and where the case might be vulnerable. Eric, welcome. Prosecutor Brad Bloodworth told jurors that Eric Richen had several times a lethal amount of fentanyl in his system, 15 nanograms per millimeter. And that, this level, proves intent, not an accident. The medical examiner confirmed that this was a toxic dose. How does the prosecution use dosage to quantify and to argue premeditation? And is five times a lethal dose genuinely as dispositive as they're arguing here? We are talking fentanyl, and just the tip of a needle is enough to kill, basically. So we're talking five tips of needles. Again, not a whole lot. It's very easy to overdose and die from this. What's your thoughts on that argument that they're bringing to the jury?
It is, and I think they're smart to sort of leverage that dosage. Every case is good facts and bad facts, and that's a good fact for the prosecution. Because, you know, especially if defense gets up there and says this was an accidental overdose, usually accidental overdoses are, you know, one time the lethal amount, two times the lethal amount. Someone usually doesn't just take, you know, a monster amount of substance unless it's a non-accidental overdose and they were trying to commit suicide, which is another possibility. But I think the prosecution is going to argue that, hey, this dosage was something that was calculated. There was the intended outcome here. It wasn't, recreational. It wasn't accidental. Whoever administered this dosage intended for Eric Richens to die, and we're saying that's Corey Richens.
You know, there's all sorts of evidence, obviously, that comes to play in a courtroom. You have the physical evidence, you have circumstantial evidence. Some of that circumstantial evidence these days is digital evidence, digital footprints that come to light. Surprisingly or not, It seems to have a weight to it that sometimes is heavier than DNA, that sometimes is heavier than an eyewitness, sometimes heavier than even physical evidence, because it dives into the psyche of the person in question, the person being accused. And there's a lot of that in this case. You have the internet search history showing Corey searching, what is the lethal dose of fentanyl? Could be an innocent question. Could be a, well, they say he died of this. I'm curious what that is. How long do life insurance companies take to pay? Again, could be, my husband just died. He was our source of income. I wonder how long that takes. There's other searches, though. Can cops uncover deleted messages, iPhone? And there's others too that that aren't so explainable, if you will. How do you build a narrative around digital forensics like this without feeling like you're cherry picking from someone's search history and the jury's going, ah, you're just doing this to make it look like that? How do you really help the jury fully see the context of this person's, for lack of a better term, depravity in their search history?
Yeah, you know, I think one compelling component of digital forensics is that it can show depravity. It can show these like character traits. We're talking about DNA, we're talking about fingerprints. That's sort of a sterilized type thing. You know, you don't really get a glimpse into the psyche of the person, but like you said, with digital forensics, you know, you're learning what's going on inside this person's head. And one thing you do is you match those searches up with other external evidence, witness statements, you know, including like, I can't remember who was Eric or somebody else who said, you know, if I die, it was my wife or something along those lines. When you combine those searches with this other external evidence that appears corroborative, then it looks less like cherry picking and more like a totality of the story that the prosecution is conveying to this jury about what happened.
I found it interesting that the defense of Corey Richens, she, in her opening statements and in some of her arguments that she's made so far, the attorney has been, they were going to work it out. They, you know, they had their hiccups, they've had their problems, but they're still together and they're wanting to make this work. Okay. But why is Corey booking an all-inclusive Caribbean resort vacation for herself and her boyfriend for a month after Eric dies? This was actually booked before Eric died, and it was planned. I mean, it's not exactly going to the timeline or the storyline of, oh, we're going to work this out. You're not going on a Caribbean all-inclusive vacation with your boyfriend if you're working on your marriage. And I guess, I mean, it's one thing to say, okay, we're not going to judge their marriage. Maybe they're in an open relationship, whatever. That's their deal. That's their business. But they're not saying that. They're saying, oh, no, they're tight. They're loving. They're figuring this out. And there's so much evidence to the contrary. It seems like a weird road to go down, a weird argument to make, because it's so easily disproven. Is that a mistake on the part of the defense of Corey Richens to try and when everything points to the exact opposite of that, like actual evidence?
You've got to be so careful as a defense attorney to try and maintain your credibility with the jury, because sometimes from the very beginning, they're looking at you with a side eye. They're like, oh my God, your client's accused of homicide and you're representing him. And then when you get up there, if you're overplaying your hand, if you are trying to sell them something that is not substantiated by evidence, might be contradicted by evidence, you can ruin that credibility. And that causes the jury to look skeptically at all the other evidence and cross-examination and everything else the defense intends to present. And so you've got to be so careful about that. And this one seems like a bit of an oversell to me, especially when there's the trip booked and everything else. I think the jury might look at that and say, you know, she's lying to us about what Corey wanted to do with this relationship. What else is she lying to us about?
Another thing that the prosecution is trying to connect is the Valentine sandwich. I'd still like to know what the sandwich was. I really would. Like, what type of, was it an Italian? Was it like ham and cheese? Whatever. That seems to be missing in this story.
Swiss? I don't know.
I mean, what did Eric like? What are you mixing the fentanyl with? Because there's the sandwich, and then there's Corey procuring drugs. You know, supposedly oxy. There's something was in that sandwich. We don't know what, because then he says he got violently ill, maybe took an EpiPen, maybe did not, laid down, but he survived. And he told his friends and his family, I think my wife is trying to poison me. There had also been allegations from way back. I don't think this is getting into the trial, but from way back on, a trip to Greece where he had suspected possibly that was happening. But again, we don't have the sandwich. We can't test it. We don't know. It's basically he got sick after eating a sandwich that was given to him from his wife. It could have been tainted ham, quite honestly. That's the thing. It happens. If you've ever had tainted ham,
it's not a good time.
That could possibly be an excuse. The only thing that really ties the sandwich to any sort of misdeeds, obviously the fact that he got sick, is the fact that then she's asking for something stronger from the housekeeper. The Michael Jackson stuff specifically. This is propofol, which is not what she got. I don't think she knew what she was talking about. But that's the connection there. How difficult is it going to be for the jury to believe that sandwich that she gave him on Valentine's Day was laced with something when, again, there ain't no sandwich to test, and there was no Eric that got tested either for any sort of ingestion of a poisonous substance.
Tony, I was just talking about how defense can overplay their hand. Prosecution can overplay their hand, too, and sometimes even in a more damning way. Look, if they can't back up this accusation of attempted murder by sandwich, if they don't have any substantial compelling evidence supporting that, and I'm defense up there, I'm saying, hey, look, they are trying to just throw stuff at the wall and see what sticks. This guy got sick after eating a sandwich, and all of a sudden my client's accused of trying to poison him to death. And then they're trying to buttress this other allegation of poisoning for which there is not significant evidence. Just trying to make it seem like this person's a terrible poisoner who's doing this to her husband. I think there's a chance the government overplays their hand with that accusation. I've said that from the beginning, and I think it was questionable to even bring it as part of this trial. Could backfire hugely.
You saw the body cam footage of that moment where they got there, and Corey's in her matching pajamas and her hair's up. And Eric's sister says it was weird because it looked like Corey was kind of made up, like she was prepared for company, if you will, at that moment in time. That was her take. That was her perception on it. Without going into my opinion or anybody else's opinion, what was your take on watching her actions, her reactions in that body cam video as her husband was trying to be revived by first responders?
You know, it doesn't necessarily align with how we might expect to see someone in that scenario who was innocent reacting. Certainly there's the specter of, was she orchestrating this all along? She knew the police would be there. She coordinated her appearance in a way that she wanted to present. And, she saw this coming. Or is it just that, gosh, this was just her normal actions and she didn't really know what to do or how to react when her husband is dead? And so, I'm not sure it moves the needle too far one way or the other. I think the prosecution is going to make a bigger deal out of it than it might be. And again, that could be the prosecution overplaying their hand and then them losing credibility with the jury potentially.
And the prosecution, the big thing in their hand that they seem to be trying to play is that this whole thing was financially motivated. The day Eric died, Corey owed about $4.5 million to more than 20 different lenders, was about to close on a $3.2 million mansion she couldn't afford. And Eric had over 200 overdraft transactions totaling $300,000 in the months before his death. So not exactly fiscally responsible. Eric apparently not happy about any of these things either in the time leading up to his death. His estate, personally, worth more than $4 million. It's quite a bridge to cross to try and convince a jury that someone took the life of the father of their three children for money, for some sort of financial security or situation. Because if you look at this, you could go, well, they could figure it out. There may be some tough times, but there's enough flowing this way and that way that they could figure this out. It doesn't necessarily seem like, do you need to murder someone over this? There wasn't like dire situations of, one's going to go be destitute next week. As a former prosecutor, how do you present financial desperation without the jury thinking lots of people have debt and don't kill their spouses?
Yeah, good question. Because I think that there was similar challenges to the motive in the Alec Murdoch case, where they were saying, oh, he killed his wife and kid because he had this financial distress going on. It's kind of a logical disconnect there. But if I'm the prosecutor, I'm saying, hey, this is real stress in a person's life. Money matters. And you know, we're not talking 100,000. We're talking 4+ million. We're talking 20+ lenders. When you see the walls closing in, sometimes you get desperate. And lo and behold, there's this life insurance policy that'll at least get me $1 million+, maybe more. That'll be a big chunk. That'll take care of a big chunk of my woes. On top of that, I'm not in a good relationship with my husband anyway. I don't like him. You know, is it so far of a measure to take to try to improve one's situation? If I'm the prosecutor, that's the argument I'm making, but there's certainly counter arguments.
At the end of the day, in this case, is she going to go down because of memes? You know what I'm talking about? Where the memes were revealed at the very end of the opening statements by the prosecution. Memes showing someone wiping their nose with $100 bills. Meme saying, I'm rich, I'm rich. And another one, basically, this would be if you were to assume that she looked these things up. Idiots everywhere, alluding to all the people, the first responders, the people who are in her home trying to help her, trying to console her, trying to figure out what happened to her husband. She is sitting there on her phone looking, idiots everywhere. My God, she like hit like three emotional pain points with those three different memes. Is that what a jury's going to look at the end of the day? All the other evidence be damned and go, bitch is going down. Because who the hell looks at those sort of things in that sort of situation? I don't know how you're going to explain that one away.
Certainly peculiar. And, you know, as we've seen social media take sort of front and center stage in some of these criminal trials with videos and posts and things like that, now we're even getting more granulated down to just memes, different memes people are looking at. What does it say about them? What does it say about what's going on in their mental state? What does it say about their intentions, how they're viewing something that has just happened? Certainly a jury could look at those and draw inferences, you know, about what was going on in Corey's head, and is that consistent with how an innocent person would act under those circumstances? So, you know, this might not be the first time we've seen memes in trials, and I think it's definitely not going to be the last, which is sort of a bizarre prospect to even think about.
We're at memes. I guess emojis are the next thing that we're going to see in a case. What did the emojis mean? What did you mean by the ham sandwich emoji and the skull and bones? That, who knows? I'm sure it will happen within the next 365 days. Eric Faddis, defense attorney, former prosecutor, as always, thank you so much for coming on and giving us your insight into this and the many cases we got going on here. Give us your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and also on YouTube. Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi is what you search on YouTube. The link for Substack is in the description. And of course, be sure to press subscribe wherever you're watching or listening to this so you don't miss any of our coverage. We'll continue our conversation there in the comment section. Until next time, for Todd and Eric, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Moro Casino. America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Normally in these ads, you expect somebody to ask you to buy something, but this is something different. I'm Julian Barnes, and I'm a reporter for the New York Times. I'm a national security reporter, and that means I'm reporting on military operations. These are fast-paced, quickly moving situations. What exactly is happening on the ground is often shrouded in mystery, but we turn to trusted sources, satellite imagery, and expertise built up over years in order to ferret out the facts that wouldn't otherwise come to light. I'm here to ask you to seek out a news source that does firsthand fact-based reporting. If it's your local paper, great. If it's the Times, thank you. Because where you go for your information matters.
Every dating app swipe is another loss. Gym bros, fake CEOs, straight up losers. So now the only app I open is Moto Casino, because at least there I'm surrounded by winners, real winners, thousands of them. While everyone else is in the single swamp, I'm at home relaxing while stacking bonuses, hitting wins, and playing all my favorite Vegas style games. Moto Casino, the only app worth your time.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Download the Moto Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
10 hours on my feet, traffic, noise, everybody needing something from me. My head is spinning. I just need the world to stop for 1 second. But then I get home, shoes off, phone out, and I open Modo Casino. Hundreds of slots, classic table games. It's my instant reset. The variety I want in the quiet I need.
Modo Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Modo.us for more details. Download the Modo Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Modo Casino. America's social casino.
John Daly here.
You know what day it is? Neither do I. I live life daily. That's why I only spin on Moto Casino. Moto's got daily free bonuses, daily tournaments, new slots added daily. And the best part? Guaranteed daily jackpots. You can't beat that. So today's the day you grip it and spin it with me on Moto, America's social casino.
Play for free on Moto.us.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Download the Moto Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.